It is Saturday, July 4th, 2009, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on GeekSpeak, geek news, and in the second half, your questions and comments about technology. The bandwidth for GeekSpeak.org is provided by GNI, GNIHosting.com. It's time now for GeekSpeak. Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KOSP. Today on GeekSpeak, we're starting with geek news in the first half, and in the second half of the show, I'm going to welcome you to join our conversation. You can ask us anything you like. We might not have the correct answers, but we'll definitely answer your questions. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can go to GeekSpeak right now, participate in our online chat, or you can send us email or through our forums. We're here to help you. It's lots of ways to contact us. This is GeekSpeak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, I have geeks. Miles Elam, he's a former slacker, currently an instructor at Stanford, and always a political junkie. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning.
I also have Al Luckow. Al Luckow is a new media architect centered in Ben Lomond, California.
Hello, everybody.
And through Skype from Oakland or Berkeley, Oakland, we have Ben Jaffe.
Good morning.
And you said it was Berkeley?
It is Berkeley.
And are you right on that borderline where it's kind of Berkeley and kind of Oakland?
I'm like 8 blocks from the Oakland-Oakley area, if you want to call it that. The line where rent is way more expensive in Oakland, but it's technically Oakland.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Ben Jaffe from Oakland. Welcome.
Thank you.
let's start with a robot update. Al, what's going on in the world of things that take over our planet?
I don't even know where to begin. I'm really just... Why are you looking at me like that?
Why?
You're just... You got this sort of mechanical look about you. I'm feeling like there's...
Can I confirm to you that I am not a robot? But that's what a robot would say.
Hello, Joe. What do you know?
Hello.
Oh, no, you're supposed to say just got back from a vaudeville show. See, we have to come up with these ways of finding out if people
robots
are really robots or not. And you're thinking, why would he say that? Well...
Does that mean that I just failed the vaudeville test and therefore I'm a robot?
You're a robot.
The vaudeville Turing test.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't thought of a good question, but I'll think of something. But one of the reasons I bring that up is I saw this article about Walt Disney World has this big thing that was actually designed by Disney himself that has all the presidents.
The Hall of Presidents.
It's like the Hall of Presidents, and they're all animatronic, but, you know, over time they've just gotten better and better and better.
Wait, the robots that are there, or they've built new ones that are better?
The people who build the robots, the Imagineering team, and the robots themselves, they're very realistic looking, and they just finished the Obama one.
Really?
And I went and looked at it on, they have a YouTube thing, but, you know, there's a link on our site, and it shows you... you know, all the robots and lets you see them. And they even show Obama, you know, they say, hey, look, we built this robot of you. And, you know, he comes in there and he read for them. And he kind of assisted them in making the representation of himself. And I don't know, man, it looked real. It wasn't like he was doing jumping jacks or anything. He was just kind of standing there. But the way they do the mannerisms and stuff, he's moving his hands and he's talking. And, you know, I don't know. It's very realistic.
So much so that it's kind of creepy? Is it get to that point where it's a little...
Oh, it's certainly creepy.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm thinking, last time I saw Obama on TV, he was really moving around a lot, you know? You know what we should do? Mm. Before somebody goes on TV and you want to make sure that they're real, have them walk upstairs.
Because stairs never look natural.
Because robots, they never seem to be able to walk upstairs.
Hello, friend. I'm not going to talk to you until you walk up these stairs.
I brought these stairs with me. You did? Why did you bring stairs with you?
All right. Besides Obama now being a zombie, I mean a robot.
Oh, there's
a fine line there. What else is going on?
I was just thinking, robot has trouble walking upstairs, but convincing you through speech and mannerisms that they're a human being, that's simple. never mind. Okay. Yeah.
Well, there's...
That's
you
really
know,
strange, isn't it?
There's a whole bunch of things. There's a it's called Ninomiya-kun book reading robot. the it's a 1 meter tall, 25 kilogram aluminum framed robot developed at Waseda University, and it apparently can like turn pages of a book and read them. You know, they have it like they show it reading children's stories, and it can look at the book pages and then read the, you know, sort of an OCR thing, and it can read the story and then turn the pages. It's a very, you know, they built it and it looks like a, it's like a child, like child sized robot. I don't know. It seems like the Japanese make a lot of child sized cute robots, it's, you know, when just trying to, you know, let people see them and they don't realize how ominous they are.
Yeah.
You know,
I, for one, welcome our page turning robot overlords.
Well, I have kids too, or, you know, so I have got my, a lot of, page turning and, but man, you know, you get this, and then and there's another robot that I read about, and this one is it's a realistic robot hand that they show handling sushi. So oh. it's basically a fleshy robot hand. It weighs 340 kilograms, and it's a soft silicone skin stretched over a polycarbonate skeleton. That sounds very Terminator-like.
It does sound like it's going
to. It has 22 hurt. Pneumatically powered artificial muscles that enable it to bend its fingers like a human hand, and it can perform 20 different moves. This is, you know, it's just hand. It was developed by a Kyoto-based factory.
Mm-hmm. Does it look good?
It looks like a real hand, and they show it picking up sushi and doing all these things.
With chopsticks.
No, it's picking it up with its hand, you know, and sushi is hard to pick up, you know. I mean, I'm purposely leaving out all the jokes I could say about having a realistic robot hand here.
Thank you.
But the whole thing about it, you know, you got a hand, you know, kind of like the one on, what was that show that
had the hand on it? Yeah, I know. I was trying to think of the thing, right.
It was Adam's Family or
Thank
something.
Thank you, Adam's Family. You know. You're so much more pop culture than me.
Well, the whole keeping robots in the media, you know, like this movie. Now, I don't know if this is real or not, but there's one called Geisha is Robot.
That's a great one. And that's a preview you can read from our site.
Yeah. I mean, all I can say is if you can handle it, you should go check out our site and watch this trailer to this movie. It's got these geishas that are robots, and they're just running around fighting each other, and they've got all these swords popping out of every orifice and flames coming out of their mouths.
Okay,
and,
are there any... So that looks like... I mean, definitely see the trailer. It's a blast. Are there any robots this week or technology that's, you know, using blood or anything of that nature?
Yeah. Oh, sure. We can talk about the carnivorous clock that eats bugs. And it's powered. It was designed... it's from UK-based designers James Auger and Jimmy Larzieu. And it traps insects on fly paper stretched across a roller system. And then the fly is, you know, conveyor
scraped
belted
off,
down and deposited into a vat of bacteria. And then there's a chemical reaction or, like, digestion that transforms it into power.
Okay.
Now, I don't even want to say how... I mean, these are just bugs, you know. Who cares about bugs?
But we've all seen, like, the tomato or the potato clock, right? Where you take an anode and a cathode and stick it in a potato and it powers it. A clock doesn't need a lot of power. So this basically is taking a small amount of power. It just happens to be killing flies and eating them to get its power.
Yeah, but it's using, like, living things and then it's killing them
and then
using them for power.
And the thing that scares
me... If I just said that part about it, robots are killing things and using them for power.
Yeah, I for one welcome our insect-eating robot overlords.
The thing that scares me about this clock, seriously, well, not seriously, is the idea that an animal, large animal that dies, collects a lot, you know, attracts a lot of flies. So when is the clock going to make the move to start killing its owners? You know,
and
collecting flies.
It'll say, how can I collect more flies?
Exactly.
If I kill a larger animal, I can collect more flies. And then it's going to realize.
Okay, you take the clock like that, and you get one of those printers that can self-replicate, and those two things together, we've got a problem.
Well, the same guys that designed this thing, they also have an alternative design fueled by mice.
That's
wrong. And they have another contraption. They have another one. It's a robotic arm that plucks insect fuel from spider webs with the help of a video camera. It plucks the...
So the spider
builds a web like it normally does. I'll build a web here. It's a perfect spot. And it starts putting, you know, catching bugs. And before the spider can get to it, the robotic arm says, "It looks like a good bug." Takes the bug, uses it, and basically what's going to end up with is spider starvation.
Yeah, spiders will be starved.
There'll be a lot of really thin
emaciated spiders.
Yeah,
looking,
but they're thin
know
already.
What, but they'll all know what time it is. They'll all know what time it is. Okay.
And there's one more thing.
All right, go ahead.
They have a lamp powered by insects, and the lamp is lured by the ultraviolet LEDs. So you have a lamp, and then the bugs fly to the lamp, and they're used for fuel, which to me, okay, that would be a good idea.
Can it be mosquitoes? Because then it's everything you need.
Yeah. Well, then it wouldn't necessarily be a lamp. You'd want to emit some CO2.
Well, that would
attract the mosquitoes.
Right. I was just thinking it'd be nice if it was powered by the mosquito, you know.
You could power that thing forever at my house, man.
A lot of mosquitoes.
Can I just say, all of our robot stories put together, we've got some really bad news. Self-replicating printers, carnivorism, super strong hands, convincing good looks and mannerisms, climbing telephone poles, and machine guns. Those don't go very well together.
Yeah, and you know what? When they come, I'm allying myself with them. I'm selling you guys out. Better to be on the right-hand side of the devil than in his path.
Wow.
That's a very
thanks,
good
Miles. That's so nice of you.
Man.
All right.
I'm not offended. It's okay.
That's just because you're not local. You don't see as evil looking
well, right
eyes
now,
as
Ben is coming to us digitally. We assume it's Ben.
It's true. We don't know.
Yeah, Ben, walk up some stairs.
Yeah. Ben can't walk upstairs. He's a robot.
Turing test, anyone?
All right. Let's do the next news story. Actually, you know, Miles and Ben, you both have Hulu stuff, so I guess we're doing Hulu stuff. Miles, why don't you start with yours?
Well, it's a very simple story, which is The Simpsons. Mm-hmm. Very popular show. It's been on since the last Ice Age, something like that. And what they're finding is that the targeted advertising on Hulu generates more revenue than the advertising put up on Fox on TV.
That's amazing. Okay, so Hulu is an online television delivery site. Hulu.com, it's free to watch television. They put ads in it, just
right.
Like over the air.
As opposed to, I mean, it's actually very much like TV, where on TV a commercial comes up and you have to sit through it and wait for it to come back. Hulu does the same thing. The video suspends and then you have some commercial having to do with
so basically
you
it's
know, a car
TV.
Commercial or something like that.
Basically, it's TV.
It is TV. It's TV just delivered through your computer. That's the only difference.
So it's just
and,
TV in your computer.
I mean, the way that I do it at home, I actually have a S-video out on my TV and audio out, and it goes from my computer, and it goes to my TV.
Did you know
so
that your
I
TV
watch
can
it
do
my
it?
TV.
Your TV can do that all by itself. And you don't even need an internet connection?
What are you talking about?
You can just turn the TV on and watch a show.
But it does save on cable costs.
I don't have cable right. connection to my house. But the thing that's so nice is that you can go ahead and, you know, watch four shows of the same show.
Uh-huh.
It's like a TiVo built in that you don't have to deal with.
Or for that matter, if I want to watch The Simpsons at 11:30 at night, or rather 11:22 at night and watch an episode, I can do so and not have to watch at, you know, what is it, 8 o'clock on whatever.
Whatever it is. You wouldn't do that, though, because you're always asleep by that time. All right. That's Ben, do you have some more information about this? Interesting.
I have more information. It's the same story, though, Miles. Thanks a lot. But on this story.
Whatever. I tagged it on the website first.
I tagged it on first. I tagged
Ben wins.
You put your story.
Okay, anyway.
Some stats from the article.
Yeah.
Online, it's about $60 per 1,000 viewers for something like The Simpsons, as the example, on Hulu. And on TV for primetime television for, say, something like The Simpsons, it's somewhere between $20 and $40 per 1,000 visitors.
Okay.
So
here's a question I have. On the television, it's national, right? So don't you always have to buy an amazingly large block of purchases? You can't, like, say, I only want to serve this ad to 1,000 people.
Yeah.
But on Hulu,
so
you can do that.
I would say that's a downside.
Yeah.
So like
Hulu,
all or nothing.
Hulu allows you to target a specific demographic area?
I don't know about
show.
That.
A show, but, and you can, of course, only buy – you don't have to buy 1,000 views, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you
could
theoretically
so
buy 1,000. You'd have to have to do it international. If they could do it by IP block range to kind of specify geography, that would be very different.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is on Hulu, there are quite a few fewer online advertisements than on television.
Yeah, there is.
And also – and as a result, they're also much shorter. And as a result, they're very much more memorable.
And
then
people,
furthermore,
if they're shorter, of course, and there's fewer of them, it's more likely that a person will sit through it and watch it. So
absolutely.
Go on.
And furthermore, the people who go to Hulu are deciding to watch the show. They're seeking it out actively. Whereas on television, sometimes it can just come to them passively, which means that they're probably more likely to pay attention to the advertisement as well.
Yeah, passively, like a potato sitting on a couch.
Yes.
Very passive.
Very.
Potatoes.
I just shot Miles over a band for that one. All right. Thanks, Ben and Miles, for the Hulu update. It's the only way I actually watch television at this point.
I just found the last stat I want to mention. Online programs have an average of 37 seconds of commercials during, say, one episode. Primetime TV averages 9 minutes of advertisements.
That's a reason to watch Hulu on television. Or on
So I think Hulu wins.
I guess so.
Of course, I have TiVo, and I have 0% advertising.
Yeah, right. You never watch the advertising.
It zip past them.
Well, you do have the boop, boop.
It's a pain.
What's the sound? Can you make the sound of the TiVo? Yeah, good.
Wow.
That's amazing. Wonderful. All right. And since you've just amazed us with your ability to emulate sounds, what's going on this two centuries on cryptography?
I thought this was kind of a nice 4th of July story.
Yeah, oh, good.
Because it's 4th of July. Happy 4th of July,
Happy
everybody.
Happy 4th of July.
Well, thank you.
I always keep forgetting when the 4th of July is.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Did something special happen on 4th of July?
It's a holiday.
Well, they usually have fireworks. Yeah. I remember the 4th of July because they had fireworks last year.
Hmm. Well,
I don't know why, though.
This story is about President Jefferson. And apparently, he was into ciphers and coded messages and things like that. And, you know, he corresponded with a friend of his. The guy's name was Robert Patterson.
Yeah, Patterson. Patterson's one of those founding father guys, right?
Uh-huh. He was a mathematics professor. And him and Patterson, you know, if you've ever read the book, you know, John Adams, you know that these guys in, you know, 200 years ago, people wrote back to each other all the time, and they wrote like really nice letters, and they had interesting things to say. And
like
stuff.
Email.
Like, we write emails now that have no attention to spelling, and sometimes they're fragmented sentences.
Well,
sometimes they're just like streams of characters that we call links and nothing else.
But there's also that issue, though, of right now, a few of us live further away. Like Ben, for example, speaking to us from
Oakland.
What? Yeah.
Officially Oakland.
What, 100 miles away from us?
It's like Berkeley. That,
Or 75, or whatever.
I'm 8 blocks away, but it's Berkeley.
But the thing is, back then, you couldn't just hop over to a friend's house. Your nearest neighbor was a couple miles away sometimes, especially in pastoral areas. So this is necessary. You know, to write these letters, to have correspondence with other people was necessary. And whereas today, it's so immediate. I don't know that it's really to say that they took more.
I would say
more
that,
care.
I would say that the
they had to
the investment in a letter and being able to be personable and have a relationship through that form and be good at writing.
good said.
Thanks. was something that was necessary because you couldn't have communication in conversation form.
Well, it's a reflection.
And
of
we
the,
do that. We
it
do
was
a
reflection of
now.
The culture at the time.
Yeah, and we. So. But we
well,
do.
But
we,
the culture was driven by the fact that if you had a misunderstanding in that letter, you had another month before you could rectify that.
And I think we've replaced that to some degree with phone conversations where everything is more immediate. If you got a problem, you just call. You know, that
or for that matter, if you write something in an email that doesn't make any sense or
they
is inflammatory, you can get back a response within 5 seconds saying, say what?
Well,
and clarify it.
What I was going to bring up
here
do, is that they'd put on these little secret messages in the correspondence back and forth. And nobody's ever really been able to figure it out. They know that it was a secret code and, you know, what does that mean? Or nobody's even able to figure it out. But it's finally been figured out by this guy. I guess it's a guy. Lauren Smithline, a 36-year-old mathematician. He has a PhD in mathematics and works professionally with cryptography and code breaking at the Center of Communications Research in Princeton, New Jersey, which is a division of the Institute of Defense Analysis. So he's a smart guy. And he's figured this whole thing out. And it turned out that there was the overall calculations necessary to solve the puzzle were fewer than 100,000, which Dr. Smithline says would be tedious in the old days, but probably doable. And he figured out the pattern and everything, how it worked. Basically, the message said, in Congress, July 4th, 1776, a declaration by the representatives of the United States of America, blah, blah, blah.
Is it the whole thing?
It's a segment of it. And, you know, you don't know whether he was helping them write the Declaration of Independence or if they were just, it was a joke.
And to be clear, this code was broken now because someone started focusing on it because we have processing power to do it. I mean, it's one of those ciphers
actually,
we actually had to know.
He used a computer.
Interesting.
And to really kind of do it, which is, you know, what we can do now. And
right.
He had to come up with an algorithm. It was still hard to do and figure out. But, you know,
there's pretty complicated ways of ciphering things. I mean, a great example to do, it's really about knowing the secret, right? So if you and I share the same printed book, and then I say to you kind of privately, page 30 is the page we're going to be using, I can then send you messages that are an encryption of my message based off of the text on page 30 of that shared book.
Right.
And that is really hard to break.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's
Or the World War II solitaire cipher.
What was the solitaire cipher? Everyone had a deck card that was ordered in a certain way, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, do not drop that
deck
of cards.
Yeah, I mean, that...
Or submarines die.
But you know, translating, you know, in one sense, we're using the computers, but I can say that I wanted to bring this up. It's kind of related. It's a website called Translate It. And it's got an 8 in the middle, translate 8, you know. It's one of those things. But basically, it's an area where you type in what you want to say, and then you hit translate, and it converts it into, like, the slang that you use on SMS, you know, and it changes all the words so that, you know, instead, you know. And so it's actually kind of good, like, if you're a parent and you're seeing your kids, you know, use all this stuff. You can use it in reverse and figure out what exactly they're saying. But you can also do things like if you only have 256 characters or however many they allow you, you can go in here and, you know, it'll just translate your whole sentence down and it'll shorten everything using all these, like, you know, weird symbols and stuff instead of that you can supposedly read, you know.
Okay, so it's Translate It.
Translateit.com.
Well, we'll link it from our site.
Yeah, and it's in the site, but it's like a transl and then the number 8 and then it. So it's, you know, they're doing their own thing.
I see. And of course,
I think it's a robot thing.
I thought we could use this to fool robots.
And the interesting thing is it's actually, in a reading sense, it sounds the same. So it's really just a translation from a text perspective. So is turns to IZ, for example. Yeah.
So basically we could use this to communicate back and forth and it would confuse the heck out of robots because they see the
so
number
this is
8.
An anti-robot measure.
Yes, it's another one of those things we can use to talk to each other and not have robots eavesdropping on our conversations.
We're going to go on with news as we wait for calls. And I believe I wanted to go to... Oh, I've lost track of my thing. Oh, yes, Miles, it's you. Yes, that's right.
So you may think... that I mean, out there as a listener, that you may have a crappy internet connection, but you got nothing on a city in Italy who has sent a radio control submarine down into their sewers to lay fiber optics, to lay a fiber optic line.
So this robot's actually pulling a fiber optic line through a complicated sewer system. The sewer system probably is 200 or 300 years old, right?
Probably.
I would assume.
If it's Italy?
Yeah.
I mean...
Maybe longer. I don't know how long, but yeah.
Well, that's... I mean, we're talking really old.
We're talking Milan. So yeah, it's an older city.
How old are sewer systems for cities?
Well, I was actually in...
There used to be a street.
I was in this French sewer system when I went to Paris and visited it, and they have a tour of their sewer.
And how do you remember how old it was?
If we're talking Milan, I would say Roman era.
Yeah, I mean, it's like aqueduct.
If I were to
time,
make a guess.
I'm just curious, because I know that at some point in the...
I mean, obviously updated.
Are there any sewer experts out there that could...
I bet there are. We'll find out.
Let us know on how old the sewers are.
Okay, anyway, but moving on.
This RC submarine is available actually in many U.S. hobby shops. I mean, you could buy them here. It's about $600.
Wow.
And so just
so it's
able
a consumer
to,
product.
Yes, absolutely a consumer product. Wow. That they attach a line to it, send it on through, and yeah.
Maybe we'll see it on Woot. Buy two of them.
It's probably not.
I guess the hardest part would be tracking it, making sure that you know where it is at all times. But, you know, a remote control
camera. It makes so much sense because, of course, in a city, you're trying to deal with running lines. That's a line that goes to every building.
Yep.
It's, you know, really smart. I'm sure this is more used for the main branches rather than into everybody's home. I mean, you know, having a wire coming out of your toilet
is
probably not
the best
solution.
This is neighborhood to neighborhood.
Right.
Honey, there's a robot coming out of the toilet. Really?
The internet connection.
Yes.
We really shouldn't add the whole sewage swimming part to the robot, to the super robot. that we're building in our
no,
minds.
No, that's perfect. Can travel through the sewers. That's a pretty dangerous robot.
I, for one, welcome our sewage swimming submarine robot overlords.
There are robots in the sewers. That's a new movie.
Perfect for whom?
Or band name.
That's for the robots.
New band name.
Miles,
well, I think you're a robot.
I might be. Ask me to climb stairs.
You said that's perfect. That's perfect.
Mr. Jaffe, what's going on with the planet mapping project?
A planet mapping project? Oh, my. Okay. Let me just click on my tab here.
You mean you're not ready?
I was ready. God,
so
unprofessional.
God, he's way over there. Nothing to do. No distractions.
I know. I'm just like sitting, reading.
In his pajamas still.
And drinking.
I hope you're dressed. Okay. Topical map.
I always get dressed for GeekSpeak.
Okay.
okay. So anyway, so now we have the most complete Earth terrain map that's ever been published. So before we had 80% of the Earth's landmass with these digital elevation maps. And that was back in January of 05. I think they may have finished in December of 04. But in any case, we just finished mapping almost the rest of the planet. Now we're 99% of the way there.
And this is a topographical map using radar.
I believe it's using radar. I know it was done via satellite, yes.
Wait, so, of the entire planet or just land?
Of the Earth's surface.
Including underneath the ocean.
No, Earth's surface. That's not a surface.
Yes, there is a surface underneath the ocean. Thank you very much.
When you're talking about the Earth's surface, you're talking about land and water.
No.
That's the surface. The surface of the water, the surface of the land. Yes, I win.
I don't know.
Semantic win of miles. It's impossible to do. any case.
Yeah, I think topographical maps are under the water too, right?
Yeah, but it's actually a lot harder to map underwater.
Yeah, you can't do that via satellite, can you?
No, I don't know.
I don't know. Well, in any case, of whatever this wants to map, it got 99% of it.
Okay, so let's assume that it's got a whole bunch of flat area, which is just surface of the oceans, which is depressing as all get out. But very cool. Thank you, Mal. Thank you, Ben.
Yeah, it's pretty fantastic. It was taken by Japan's Advanced Spaceborne Thermal Emission and Reflection Radiometer called ASTER. I could have just said ASTER, aboard the Terra satellite, and it's a collaboration between the between NASA and between the Japanese Trade Ministry. And when this data is made available, it will be made available for free for use.
Nice.
Which is fantastic.
Thank you, Mr. Jaffe. Well, let's go ahead and start taking calls. Kelly from Santa Cruz, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you doing there?
Quite well. What's your question today?
Well, I was sitting around talking with some geeks.
I do that all the time.
And they told me that the easy way to avoid surveillance with cell phones is to chain about four or five, maybe 10 of them together with call forwarding, and that you'd need the whole NSA data mining operation or whatever out of San Francisco to trace where it went. And even then, you wouldn't necessarily be able to find it.
I seriously doubt that. I think that's erroneous.
Well, I think what you're suggesting is that you take like five cell phones and you would make a call on one of them, and then you'd connect the audio and the audio between them together, and then make a call on the other one connecting the two.
That's daisy chain.
Okay, I could see.
So then what you're talking about is let's say you have eight phones, you're talking about four phone calls, right? One phone call between the two phones and then the next one and so on, and then you do call forwarding from the first one.
But if they're on the same place, don't they use
I'm in around the world.
Oh. Different phones in different
places. Right, okay. So what you're saying is I take two cell phones, I kind of strap the audio together, I throw them off in some place.
Oh, you just call forward.
And then, or set it up to call forward?
No, if you use call forwarding, you're using the carrier. That
doesn't work
is
at all. Yeah, call forwarding is just a system where the phone company actually knows exact paths. So
okay, I don't know, but somebody told me you could do this.
Yeah, you could do it if you did a hardware solution, if you went to the analog level to some degree. And then you could do that, but it wouldn't really get you much because phone conversations can be listened to and can be recorded. So let's say you take an internet, if any call between the U.S. and outside, of course, we know gets tapped, right? So right there, that conversation is being recorded. Now, whether you could track the locations of it, no. Getting location ambiguity is pretty easy, I think, in some sense.
Well, somebody, same circle I was talking around, said that probably the NSA got all of their algorithms for data mining from Google. And they have security contracts with Google, secret security contracts.
I doubt it. I mean, Google's pretty smart at their searching and stuff, but there's probably a lot of people working on security patterns. I wouldn't really be concerned about. I mean, maybe they're using some people from Google.
Yeah.
I mean, wouldn't you go to outsource to somebody who already has the tools?
Google. The stuff that Google's doing is patented, and therefore it's in the public domain. Anybody can see what they do. A lot of it.
It's not patented.
You sure it's not patented?
Yeah.
If it were patented, it wouldn't be in the public domain.
Yeah. What I'm saying is the knowledge of it is in the public sphere. It's patented. It's public.
No, that could be real secret. Look what they did in China, man, to get the dissidents put online.
Yeah, that was much more. I mean, again, they're not really hiding what they're doing from that perspective. They're just filtering everybody's content.
My take on this is Google is not that old a company. The NSA has been doing things like this for a lot longer than Google's been around.
I guess what you can say pretty effectively is that, wow, it's amazing what Google can do. Yeah, that's being done on all data, like by lots of people.
Somebody told me right now there's a Google program that you can get by private service. It basically tells you what everybody's Googling any hour of the day.
Yeah.
You know, what
that's been around a long time.
The analysis of their search engines.
Yeah,
in fact, we have a news story about Google Trends. Yeah, Google Trends. It's actually public to some degree, I think, right?
It's
very public.
I remember seeing that in Alta Vista.
Yeah, go do a Google search for Google Trends, and you'll see what people are searching for. You won't see it by IP address or anything, but you will see what people are searching for.
One last question. You heard about Able Danger, that army group that used data mining to find Bin Laden a year before, and then they shut him down when the FBI said they couldn't use the information.
Hadn't heard anything about it.
Yeah, Able Danger was a small cell of army guys that are hackers or something, and they found by doing data mining, they found the cell in New York before the 9/11 attack, and they turned it over to the FBI, and the FBI, because they call it stovepiping, said we can't take this information because it was gathered, wrong or something like that. So the army shut down the program, and then the people in it got moved to another department.
Well, Kelly, thank you very much for the call.
Sure.
Take care. Yeah, dating mining is a pretty interesting subject. The amount of analysis you can do by having lots of collections of data is kind of creepy, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
From Pacific Grove, Tom, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Good morning. Thank you. I have an older Windows XP computer that has two hard drives. The C drive is the default drive, and I'd like to change the default drive to drive D.
Did you install Windows?
I don't know if that's. I would call myself an average user.
Did you install? Did you install Windows?
My capabilities.
Tom, did you install Windows on the D drive already? Is the D drive blank?
I believe Windows is on the C drive.
Right. Do you already have a D drive?
Yes. There's a D drive. Now the problem is that the computer came configured with the C drive as the default drive, and it's a smaller drive.
Yeah, pretty much the C drive is always the default drive. That's actually kind of the name of it. I mean, you can change it in Windows, but I wouldn't.
Yeah,
but
the short answer is no, you can't. The long answer is yes, if you copy data over just right and go through the registry and change all references from the for where program files folder is over to D and temporary files and stuff like that, you can do it. But the short answer is I would avoid that.
So he just wants a bigger drive for his main drive.
Is that true?
I mean, how hard should that? That should be easy to do.
Yeah, so
right?
Tom, what I would suggest doing is assuming you either can get rid of one of these drives, make it easier, or take a third drive. And the idea would be that you would take a new drive, you'd install it in the machine, and you'd install Windows on it. And when you're installing Windows, you'd choose that drive. And once you're done with that, that should be the bootable drive. Now, there's one little BIOS thing you have to do to change it. And you can set it up. But if you change that without having a functional copy of Windows as the default, it won't change anything from your perspective. Let me put it this way. There's Windows on the C drive right now, your computer. And when your computer starts, the only operating system it can find is on the C drive. And when it does that, that Windows is set up to make the C drive your default drive. It's connected. So you could theoretically take and add a new hard drive, change what's called a BIOS setting, and then install Windows on the new hard drive and you're set. Or you could erase the D drive and install Windows on there. But all these things, whether you could do it or not, yeah, you probably could, a little bit of assistance. Do you kind of understand what I'm talking about?
Yes, I do. Okay. I think you've answered my question.
Great. All right. Well, I didn't think I did, so that's wonderful news.
Oh, you did.
Thanks, Tom. Thank you very much. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, we got a nice update on Miles' Milan sewer story. Hal, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi. I spend a quarter of the year in Milan because my wife lives there. Mm-hmm. And the sewer system in Milan was planned in the late 19th century, the modern sewer system. mm-hmm. that you guys were referring to. What's really interesting in Milan, it used to be a very industrial city, and the industry has moved out. They used a lot of groundwater, and since they moved out, the groundwater table is rising, and the last of the three major subway lines was planned before they learned that, and now the groundwater is intruding into the last of the subway lines, so they now reward people for taking water from the municipal supply and dumping it into the sewer system.
Huh. Wow.
So to lower the water table.
The water table's, they need to lower the water table.
I think that's amazing. So many places in the world, there's not enough water, and they're like, please use water.
Use
water
up as much as you want. That's why there's so many fountains there, probably.
It's completely against everything that green architecture, green design, is that you do exactly the opposite.
So in Milan, there are none of those chemical urinals. They're all flushing, and they all do like 10 gallons of water per
going
flush.
All the time.
Yeah, going all the time.
We used to see the 70s.
Hey, thanks for the call, and thanks for the clarification.
Oh, I wanted to ask you guys, what would have happened with your encryption technology in the film 2001 if Hal hadn't been able to overhear the conversation?
Oh, yeah. That's it.
Oh, very interesting. You meaning between the radio conversation?
Yeah, I mean, he understood that they were plotting to...
Sure. It understood. Right.
But he was reading their lips through a screen, though. So,
yeah.
Or
yeah.
through a window.
He was
okay, so they would have to encrypt their lips.
They would have had to turn away from the sensor. Yeah.
And the amount of intelligence Hal kind of represented, it would probably be really hard for human brain to encrypt on the fly as fast as Hal could encode it.
Well,
you'd have to do it with metaphor or something.
We all know how intelligent Hal was.
That's true.
Another good band name, Encrypted Lips.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks so much. I think we just got a name for the show today.
Yeah. The Encrypted Lips. Yeah.
It's funny to mention that because there's a TV show based upon the movie Ghost in the Shell.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That they actually covered this. It was very much a 2001 experiment, except that in that, you had cyborgs that can speak wirelessly. So what they did is they had a conversation auditorily that the machines were able to read their lips and see what was going on, but they had a separate conversation going on through their wireless network. And so the robot goes, oh, they're just talking about a training exercise. It doesn't have anything to do with us.
Interesting. You know, that whole thing about, you know, processing power, I listened to this Escape Pod, this podcast in science fiction, and they had this whole story. One of them I listened to was this robot that, you know, they're living in amongst us, and it was like sort of, it was going to get hit by a bus, and it looked and it saw the bus coming, and it's like, oh, I can't get out of this. I'm going to die. So it instantly transmitted all these thoughts to, because they were all connected, you know, through wireless. And in like a fraction of a second, the entire story, which was like an hour long, happened in this 1 second before the robot died. You know, because it doesn't care about time. It just transferred all the data, said goodbye to all its friend robots and everything, and talked with them and everything. And it's like 1 second, just the whole thing happened, just, you know, processing.
That's a very cool idea. It's like a core dump of who you are in that moment.
Boom. And then it was killed. But, you know.
And the last few bits were.
Oh, Ben, you're Ben's cutting out. I don't know if it's your
mic.
Oh, no, he's back.
I'm back. The last few bits will be, I'll be back.
Yeah.
But that actually ties well into theories of philosophy. What are we, if not the sum of our memory? If the robot is able to send out all of its memories in that quarter second to everything it knows and that memory still exists, the robot doesn't actually ever die.
Right. Assuming all those people remember what he said.
Or the data is saved somewhere.
Okay, let's go on some more news stories. We handled the whole submarine laying fiber thing. And Ben, we're talking a bit about Google and stuff. You want to tell us what happened with when Michael Jackson died?
Yes. So with Google, when Michael Jackson died from
Oh,
Google,
Ben, I'm sorry. Ben, you're dropping out too much. We
can't
actually
horrible.
Hear
it.
But you know what? We have other news, which will be just as amazing and great. So sorry, Ben.
Fantastic.
You'll just have to listen.
He's in the distance. Hey, you know, can I mention something?
Yeah, please.
There's this guy, Nick Carr, and he's one of the people that contacted us through our forum at geekspeak.org. And he's this Australian geek who listens to our podcast live, and he does it at like 3 a.m.
Yep.
In Australia.
You wanna talk to him?
You know, I don't really know how to get a hold of him.
I do.
Really?
Yeah.
We talk because he's listening to us
right now. Just to find out if he's actually. Oh, you have him in Skype.
You may have him in Skype.
Oh, he sent you his. Or it was in his email. Yeah. His email thing.
He's from Griffith, Australia.
Yeah, let's call him up and see if he answers.
Oh, he's problem with his sound device.
Oh no.
So he can hear us two ways now.
Wow. Okay. Well,
with the time delay and without the time delay. Well, Nick, I wish we could have gotten you in.
We admire your dedication.
Thank you so much for listening. Yeah. So he's listening at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Well, it's like a ridiculous hour, and you know, just so that he can hear us live and be there. And he goes on the Etherpad and just, you know, that kind of stuff.
He's right there on
we hear that stuff in our forums.
So thank you for the people that make an extra effort to listen to us. Thank you so much for doing that.
Yeah.
Let's go ahead and do another news story. I want to know about Asteroids because I always loved the game.
Oh, man. There's a movie out, or not out yet. It's going to be out. And Universal just got the okay for it. And they're going to make a movie out of the video game Asteroids.
That's a plot, man.
I mean,
so the video game we all know, like the little triangle shooting little kind of rocks.
Why don't you describe the video?
I'll describe the whole movie.
Yeah.
So magically you appear into a triangle, and you realize that if you don't move from your location, you'll be hit by rocks. Therefore, you start shooting little pellets out of your ship. And then, all of a sudden, there's a spaceship, and it's following you.
Yeah.
And the movie ends when you die,
I'm assuming. I don't know how they're going to do it, you know, but either they're running out of ideas. I grew up playing I mean, when I was in high school, you know, Space Invaders, Asteroids, you know.
If you can make a movie out of Asteroids, you've got a lot of movies coming.
I mean,
Donkey Kong is going to be 10 times better.
What about Pong?
No, come on. Now it's just being crazy.
Imagine you're a paddle.
Imagine
there's a giant white square coming towards you. You don't know what to do.
You know, I mean. So Asteroids as a movie. I look forward to it.
And definitely, it's Universal's doing it.
It's real.
VP of production is Jeff Kirschenbaum. He's going to oversee the, you know, I don't really know how it's going to work, but I'd like to see a movie about oddly shaped polygons.
Yeah, considering Hollywood's history with making video games into movies, Hollywood, please, from a geek, please don't rape my childhood.
Well, you know,
again,
that might happen with Star Wars and such, but it's not going to happen with Asteroids. How could they ruin the video game by making a movie?
I was wondering how they could. Yeah, there are other areas where I wondered how they could possibly screw up the story, and
they did. They do,
and they did. It's amazing the ability to warp a story to something that is unrecognizable from the original.
Hey, we have flown between covering way too much Apple stuff and not enough Apple stuff all back and forth, and sometimes we decide. But this one we need to cover, iPhone vulnerability.
Yes, there's an iPhone vulnerability. It affects SMS, the instant messages on the phone. And it's actually a security vulnerability where if someone makes a carefully crafted message or a series of messages, that they can get access to the phone and do things like turn on the GPS and basically just about anything that the phone has access to. So that's the bad news.
So your phone can actually read the code from the SMS message.
Right. It has to decode the information from an SMS, like parse it.
Because I didn't know it was using that code to be running things. I thought it was just text.
Well, no, that's the whole thing is that SMS messages are 140 bytes or less. And so what a carefully crafted message can do is send more than that. So the buffer that is used to hold that, it's called a buffer overflow attack. Uh-huh. And so it overwrites past where the buffer memory or the memory buffer is
for the text message
planned for, uh-huh, and goes into program data.
Oh.
And then you make a jump point.
Well, no, yeah, it doesn't necessarily go into program data. It goes into the memory, the stack. And, of course, if you know the system well enough, you can actually inject code in the stack. And the next time when the application thinks it's going to do something else, it all of a sudden starts running your code.
It returns a function. Instead of returning back to where it came from, that function is going to return back to an arbitrary point in memory.
Which you theoretically control. Yeah.
Can mess up somebody's phone by doing that.
It's the way that when we talk about vulnerabilities, 80% of the time it's memory leak problems. Mm. And when you do this, you basically can run arbitrary code. And that means you could do a lot on the iPhone. I mean, that would be pretty serious.
Right. This comes on a platform where they had 1 million sold of the new phone within 3 days of its launch.
Is anybody going to take it?
No, this is one that's been found by people look, security researchers.
Because the thing that I'm curious about is how would you actually send an SMS through it that was longer? I would assume that AT&T would stop you from doing that.
Well, I'm sure from this vulnerability, they're looking at measures to stop it, because if this ever actually hit, this would be one of the...
devastating.
This would be the biggest cell phone exploit ever.
I mean, you could theoretically write a text message that you would send to 100 people and take over their phone and have it send text messages to all of their contacts with the virus.
Right.
So basically all iPhones would very quickly be not functional.
Right. There's, what, 20 million iPhones out there?
Something crazy like that. It's insane. So it's a bad vulnerability. And the thing that's kind of nice, of course, about a cell phone system is that you can fix some of these things relatively easily.
Right. I don't see any information with regard to if it affects the 2.0 range or the 1.0 range. But if you have a 3.0, like a new iPhone or something like that, when...
like Al has one. He just was videotaping us.
Right. Just videotaping
us. When Apple releases a fix for this by the end of the month, is what they're saying, highly recommend that you do so.
Yeah.
These security updates are, even if it's inconvenient and you have to back up your phone and do this, this is important.
I should force my wife to sync her phone then.
Syncing phone is important.
Yeah.
But this has a software update. It's not just new features or just a general bug fix. This one's important.
I'll have Lyle tell her.
Hey, Ben, are you with us again?
Well, he did.
I think I am.
Oh, you are? Okay. Yeah, it does sound like that.
Yeah.
All right, so tell us about alternative energy.
Oh, man, you're not ready.
What
okay,
are you ready for,
so
Ben?
alternative energy.
I asked you about the Jackson story, and we didn't finish it. Yeah, right.
So tell us what happened when
Michael Jackson passed away.
Jackson's story was about 2 o'clock. Some searches for Michael Jackson started to rise, and there was a humongous spike at 3 o'clock p.m. For Google searches for Michael Jackson, and the spike in searches related to Jackson was so big that Google News initially mistook it as an automated attack. Which means that for about 25 minutes, Google's system automatically forwarded people to "you look like a robot" page before they could type in a CAPTCHA and then find the article they were looking for.
So what you're saying is there's systems in place that, because one of the things that can happen is what's called a denial of service attack, and and part of the data that Google uses is actually what people are searching for, so that's actually important, and it will tune their engine, if you will. So when they're getting, 1,000 people doing the exact same search, one of the assumptions that the system would make is that this is actually not valid and there's some robot spamming us with these requests, which is like a denial of service attack. And so those protection measures actually triggered when Michael Jackson passed away, because so many people at the same time put in the phrase Michael Jackson and did a search that it looked like it was a robot.
Yes, exactly. And then more news as far as servers crashing. The LA Times broke the story. It was the first big news conglomerate who broke the story of Jackson's death, and their website crashed soon after they broke that story.
Interesting.
And then Twitter has an interesting when their servers crash, then they take you to a 404 page with a fail whale. It's a picture of a whale. And so anyway, when Twitter's servers crashed, when 66,000 tweets were made within 60 seconds, a lot of people were seeing the fail whale because their servers were down.
It'd be useful if the fail whale actually had some information on it, like, yes, Michael Jackson did pass away, and then everyone would know and it would still work.
Wait, you don't want to have Twitter be any kind of news site, with respectable information or anything.
The media, if I can use such a term, use Twitter all the time as a news source, so I don't know why I shouldn't be able to do it.
I guess so. Well, in any case, that's what happened when Michael Jackson passed away in the e-world, if you will.
Thank you. I mentioned before, but I'm going to mention again that GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. Wait, Don't Tell Me is a weekly hour-long radio quiz program. Each week on the radio, you can test your knowledge against some of the best and brightest in the news and entertainment world while figuring out what's real news and what's made up. On the web, you can play along too. That's Wait, Don't Tell Me today at noon on Central Coast Public Radio. Radio KOSP. GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by Great Infusions Coffee Beanery and Espresso Machinery Showroom, offering artisans coffees, coffee makers, and specializing in home espresso machines, parts, and repairs. Located at 317 Potrero Street on the corner of River Street in Santa Cruz, or online at www.geekspeak.com. greatinfusions.com. This is Central Coast Public Radio KOSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Auto, streaming live and podcasting at kosp.org. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. The geeks today are Miles Elam, Ben Jaffe via Skype. My name is Lyle Troxell, and Al Luckow will tell us what the crazy USB of the week device is.
Oh, yeah, this is another crazy one. Actually, a friend of ours, David Cuthbert, you know,
I do
probably like this device. It's a kit that you can buy, and it shows you how to turn a real cigar, into a USB drive. And it uses an LED, and you wire the LED in through it, and you get the drive in there, and you plug it in your thing. And it's on a little cable, and you can put the cigar down next to your computer, and the tip of the cigar glows when the USB drive is accessed. By the way, this was sent to me by a person, Sandy Dueck, a listener. And if you have, if you run across these crazy USB devices, feel free to, you know, email them in to, you know,
geekspeak.org,
and, you know, let me know about these things because there's just so many of them, you know. I mean, a cigar. I mean, this thing, it looks like a real cigar. It's just
right.
How to make it.
Out of the simplicity factor, having a cigar on you that you should plug in the side of your computer doesn't seem like a very convenient thing.
Well, it's neat.
It's neat.
This
now,
is
the
crazy.
Question is, does it get hot enough where you get the aroma of the cigar? That's the thing I want to know about.
Well, it's a real cigar, and I don't know how hot it gets.
I think later today you and I should test this whole
we'll
cigar
test this
thing.
One out. Yeah.
Hey, coming up next is Car Talk, and Car Talk is on KOSP is made possible by a grant from the Holly Family Fund at the Community Foundation of Santa Cruz County. We appreciate their support. For KOSP and for GeekSpeak, my name is Lyle Troxell. Please participate online. If you want to ask us questions, suggest a USB device of the week, whatever it is that you want to help us with the show or ask us so we can help you, you can do so at geekspeak.org. Hey, we'll see you next week.